How are we going? Only good. 10 minutes late.
That's all right. I'm just down the street.
Where are your offices?
53rd. We're in the Harper Collins building at 53rd and 5th. We're subtenants of our law firm, and they happen to be in that office, and so it's convenient for us. But
well, I was looking over the press material that was sent to me by the publicity people, and of course, I have a love for books and have for many years. I have a couple of the first editions here, the Steinbecks. I have of Mice and Men, the first edition, although it's got somebody's book plate inside.
Right, right.
And I have the Grapes of Wrath, which I bought several years ago when I was collecting first editions. I don't really seem to have the time or the money to do it these days. They're so expensive.
They're very expensive.
But I bought a copy of The Grapes of Wrath, a beautiful copy, and I thought, oh, that's expensive, $180. I said, that's more book than I'll ever purchase again. I've been offered $600 for it.
I believe it.
I can see the value of these beautiful, beautiful books. So tell me about your idea for reprinting these important first editions.
Okay. I think it really started, Don, when I had left Doubleday. I was looking for something to do, and I happened to have lunch one day with a friend of mine who's a rare book dealer, and he deals in mostly 16th century, 15th century books, and pretty much throws them around his office as if they'll last another 400 years, which they probably will. And he was talking about how the prices for modern first editions had skyrocketed, and with some disdain, I think he really said, listen, the first edition of The Great Gatsby is beautiful, with a beautiful dust jacket, but people are asking $5,000 and $10,000 with a dust jacket, and those books are deteriorating because they're all printed on acid paper. And what got me to think about was I realized I didn't know what it looked like. That there was a whole body of modern American literature that I grew up on and sort of thought of as my literature, and I'd read it all in paperback, and I'd never thought about
probably in the modern library edition.
Modern library, and then subsequently paperback, and I never had thought about what those original trade editions looked like, and it sort of startled me, having spent my career in publishing, that I hadn't thought about that. And so I began to do some research, and when I saw these books, you can't help but fall in love with them. I mean, if you like books and you love the novels themselves, when you see those original editions, there's just something wonderfully magical about them.
Yes, there's something ethereal about holding a copy of the book as it first came out at the time of the author's own life.
That's right. And so that I thought, well, one day I was sitting at my desk and the idea came to me, and I thought, well, this was a gift from God. God told me, here's what you should do. You should print these again and make them available, that they are so scarce. And as you were saying about your own copy of Grapes of Wrath, people can't enjoy them because they've gotten to be so expensive. But the fact is that books are still the great democratic medium, and they're not that expensive. And so even though we do very small printings and they are costly, we're able to make them relatively the same price as a contemporary trade book.
So, with this idea in mind, you formed the First Edition Library as a company.
Yes. We formed a company called Collector's Reprints, and the First Edition Library is just the name for the series. And we went to all the original publishers, and some cases the rights had migrated to another publisher, in some cases they resided with the author's estate. All the books that we've done so far are still under copyright protection. As you may know, that the copyright law, the current copyright law, is the life of the author plus 50 years. Some of these books predated that new law, but they're still under copyright protection. So we really went back to the publishers and said, listen, there's a right inside the bundle of rights that the copyright contains, which has not been used yet, which is the right to print a facsimile of the first edition. And so they were amenable to that. We started out with Scribner's and with the Viking Press, publishers of Hemingway and Fitzgerald, in the Scribner's case, and Steinbeck in Viking's case, and went on with Random House, who publishes Faulkner. And the publishers were very supportive, and so here we are. We now have about 20 books in print, and we are doing between 6 and 10 new ones a year.
Now, did you have to make some sort of contractual arrangement with
the
publishers?
Yes, these are all, we pay a royalty. We are like any other reprinter, in that except rather than doing a paperback edition, we're doing an edition which is the exact facsimile of that original trade edition with its dust jacket. And
Now, you have a number, a considerable number of Nobel Prize winners here. I assume that you are seeking highlights in modern American literature.
Well, you know, sometimes people ask me, well, give me an idea of what you're going to do. And I say, well, you name a novel that was published in the last 70 years in American literature, and we'll be doing it, I'm sure. So it's the full sweep. I mean, at one point, I think I said to myself that Hemingway, Fitzgerald, Steinbeck, and Faulkner were the sort of the four anchor names, and certainly that three of those four won Nobel Prizes, that I think that not only were they clearly people that we wanted to do, authors we wanted to do, but they also had multiple books. So you have other people who we've done. We did Nathaniel West, Miss Lonely Hearts. Now, there was a wonderful story in the New York Times Book Review a week or two ago on Nathaniel West on the 50th anniversary of his death. And West really wrote two wonderful classic novels, Miss Lonely Hearts and Day of the Locust, and is not all that well known, certainly not as well known as someone like Hemingway or Steinbeck, but we're definitely doing, we've done Nathaniel West, we've done Jack Kerouac, we did On the Road. We hope this year, actually, we were talking about this morning, to do William Styron's first novel, Lie Down in Darkness, which was published in 1951. So it really is, as I said, it's sort of the whole, at this point, that it's American literature, for the most part, modern American literature. We are thinking about going back and doing some late 19th century, some Mark Twain, perhaps Stephen Crane. But it's difficult to try and put an exact parameter on it, because it really is those Americans in the first half of the 20th century.
But isn't it interesting to look at these books and see how they actually appeared when they first came out?
Yeah.
Because most of us, as you yourself did, you read the paperbacks or subsequent printings, and we don't really have a feeling about the way they look. And what's also interesting is the way the dust jackets look.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting because these there was a wonderful kind of confluence of events. One was the arrival of America onto the world scene, which really occurred at the time of the First World War. And most of these writers, the modern, what we think of as those modern American writers, all began in that post-World War I period. And the world was changing, America was changing. And the interesting thing is that the printing industry was changing, that you had the advent of the four-color mass market presses, and so the graphic arts industry was developing. So many of these, the dust jacket was an unknown phenomenon in publishing in the 19th century and previous. It really was a 20th century phenomenon.
Mm.
And so just you had these things all happening at the same time, this burst of creativity from the writers, burst of creativity from the publishing houses. A lot of the houses that we think of today, Random House, the Simon & Schuster, the Viking Press, these were all Knopf, they all started about this time. And so you have them creating these very carefully attended, wonderfully designed books. I brought along one just to show you. This is a copy of the first edition of Faulkner's The Sound and the Fury.
Uh-huh.
And it's just a tremendous amount of care was put into a book which they only printed 1,700 copies. That the publisher at the time...
1,700 copies?
1,700 copies. And just to give you an idea about that, this is in fact a first edition jacket, and you can see the kind of this is not in too bad condition, but it's been very badly deteriorated. And so there was a lot of, even though Harrison Smith, who was the original publisher at that time, didn't have the highest commercial expectations. He loved Faulkner. And he put into the design of this book and the design of the dust jacket and the end papers and a kind of concern that we don't see as much of today.
How would I, as a collector or a reader, know the difference, other than, of course, the obvious age of the dust jacket in the book? How would I know the difference between your facsimile and the real thing?
Well, you raise an interesting point, that as far as the text goes, is that we have always had a legend on the copyright page which identifies that this is a facsimile, which updates, gives the updated copyright notice, and we've contained that all within a little rule so that it says everything outside of this rule is absolutely from the original edition. But as we got into it, we realized, and my wife particularly, who does a lot of the research into finding the original materials, became concerned that bibliographers and scholars, bibliographic scholars, would be confused or might be confused in the future by some of our facsimiles. Simultaneously, the Antiquarian Booksellers Association, who were very keenly aware of the value of the enhanced value of a book with a new first edition dust jacket, came to us and expressed the concern that were we aware that we might be find ourselves in the position of making counterfeit art, because that's really the collector had so highly valued these dust jackets. So at that point, we worked out a solution, which was we put our monogram, the FEL, First Edition Library monogram, on the back flap of the dust jacket, just on the, if you turn it and look on the inside at the bottom, which was a way to try and not to diminish the pleasure from looking at it. We didn't want to print across the big stamp on it. This is a facsimile. But we wanted just to mark it in a way that no one would be deceived by what these were.
I would assume that in many respects your book is better because it's on acid-free paper.
That's exactly the main, you know, the only thing that really differentiates our book from the first is that ours is printed on acid-free paper. And as you probably know, that really up until the middle or the late 19th century, all paper for newspapers, for books, was really cotton-based. And that will last for hundreds of years, literally hundreds of years. Even early newspapers printed in the United States have great durability. But starting with the tremendous increase in literacy in the end of the 19th century, into the 20th century, wood-based papers were much more inexpensive. But they have one unfortunate aspect, and that is that to be prepared to accept the ink, they're coated with a resin which interacts with the fibers and causes an acid to precipitate, which will destroy the paper. It just will crumble over the course of probably somewhere between 100 and 150 years. So the Library of Congress today estimates that they're losing somewhere between 200 and 250 books a day that are literally just falling to dust. So these books have been printed on acid-free paper and ought to last for several hundred years without any problem. So we found a wonderful reception among librarians, that there's currently actually an exhibit down at the Bopes Library at NYU, which puts their editions from their rare book library side by side with ours, with some text explaining how that the originals are in the process of deteriorating, and here are these facsimiles which will be around for scholars to use in the future.
Now, Mr. Reith, once you've decided that you want to reproduce one of these great books, how did you track down the book to see how it actually looked?
Well, it's an interesting, each one is its own detective story, that for the most part, the texts are still available through a network of antiquarian book dealers, that if you wanted to get a copy of The Great Gatsby, for instance, that you can obtain one somewhere between probably $500 and $1,000, depending on its condition. And so we would track down and would buy a copy of the text. The dust jacket materials are much, much more difficult to find. And we've been fortunate in being able to utilize some of the great research libraries, academic libraries. For instance, Beinecke at Yale has been, the rare book manuscript library at Yale has been very supportive. But just to give an example, in the case of the Fitzgerald, all the Fitzgerald materials are at the Firestone Library at Princeton University. So we were able to track down, with the help of the Scribner Company and Scribner family, those materials at Princeton. And in many cases, Princeton hasn't yet cataloged everything. So we were down looking in some areas that they have, but they haven't cataloged it yet. And we were able to find, actually my wife found the original illustration that was used for The Great Gatsby, which at the time was down in a vault someplace and now is hanging in the rare book curator's office. And we were also able to find Fitzgerald's own personal copy of The Dust Jacket from 1925, which he kept in a scrapbook. And so he'd kept it away from the light for the last 70 years, 65 years. And so we were actually, Princeton allowed us to photograph that and to use that as the basis for making new four-color plates for the dust jacket.
Well, tell me about the photographing of these books. How technically does that work?
Well, again, just as I said earlier, there was a wonderful kind of confluence of events to create these wonderful dust jackets in the first place, that we probably came along at the right time in terms of new technology, that there is a piece of graphics technology today called a Cytex machine, which essentially digitizes a piece of art so that you can effectively retouch or restore color. And so we would take a photograph of dust jacket materials and then convert that onto the Cytex machine. So where they were rips or they were scuffing on the original materials or the color had faded, we were able to restore that using this machinery and the technology, so that what we get are printing plates which are as if they were the plates from the original printing.
Now, I'm a little confused when you say we took a photograph. You don't mean taking a 35-millimeter camera.
No, no. It's an 8x10 studio. It goes into a studio where a chrome is made, transparency is made, very, very high saturation of color. And so most of these libraries are set up because there's much heavy use by scholars. They have fairly sophisticated reproduction studios.
So you could do it right at the site.
We could do it at the site. In Princeton's case, we did it off-site. We did it at a studio in Princeton. At Yale, a lot, they do all of their work on-site.
Well, what about, did you also photograph the text itself?
The text is offset from an original edition.
You couldn't fold it flat, though, to do it.
Well, you can. We found a supplier. It's interesting, and most of the people who do offset work want to cut the book apart because they feel that's the only way. But we researched this and found a supplier up in Massachusetts that was capable, has a technique where they're able to photograph without snipping the binding, without breaking the book open. And so that we've been able to do that.
Boy, so many things against you. First, you got to get permission from the original publisher. You have to locate the book and the dust jacket. You have to use the modern technology to take pictures of these books and reproduce them accurately. I mean, that's a tremendous undertaking, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, it is, but it's. I think one of the wonderful things about this enterprise is that I really feel like I'm a kid in a candy store. and I keep wondering, when's the magic going to wear off? And it hasn't happened yet. And every time I see a new book begin to take shape, I can't believe that it's as beautiful as it really is. That there's something about just being able to restore to its original pristine condition that just gives me a thrill. And to be able to make those books available so people can own them as they first came into the world continues to be a charge. So it's worth all the effort.
Now, once you have overcome all of these other hurdles, you have something else to overcome, and that's reaching the public. How does someone, a book collector, learn about the first edition library?
Well, that's again a good question. We really sell, we do not distribute through bookstores. And just to give you an idea of some of the problems there, that when we were first talking with Viking Press, that is the publisher of Steinbeck and The Grapes of Wrath, we realized that how can you have two hardcover editions? Viking continues to have the book in hardcover. They recently brought out a very handsome 50th anniversary edition of the book, which does not look anything like the original, but it's a very handsome edition all by itself. So to have in the stores two copies from different publishers but the same title with the same imprint, because our copy carries the Viking Press imprint. So we have pretty much decided that our books are sold through two ways. One is through a subscription series, very much like a book club, where people will sign up and we will, as I mentioned earlier, we're doing 6 to 8 new titles a year, and so as new releases are available, they get shipped automatically to the subscribers. And then we also sell we have a mail order catalog, and we solicit inquiries. The word is beginning to sort of filter out to people that we exist, and there's been a lot of word of mouth. And so then we will sell individual titles on a one-by-one basis to people who are interested in acquiring them.
Are you planning to advertise, such as in the Times Book Review?
We have done some advertising in the past. I'm always sort of feel a mixed response when someone asks me that, because I say, well, that means that there are more people out there who haven't seen some of our ads, so it'll be worthwhile to run another one. We have done some advertising in the Book Review. We've done some advertising in The Atlantic, Harper's, New Republic, other kinds of quote-unquote book media. We do have a toll-free telephone number, which is 800-345-8112. And that is a toll-free number where people can both call and get a brochure, or they can call and place individual orders to just get information.
You know, the idea of subscriptions is not new. It has, as a matter of fact, Mark Twain's books, his early books, were all sold on a subscription basis.
That's right.
As were, in the earlier part of the century, Ambrose Bierce's
That's right.
books were sold on a subscription basis. And that seemed to be the preferred way of selling back in the 19th century and early part of the 20th century.
Absolutely. Well, it was a way for publishers to try and ascertain how much of a market there was before they went out and put the money into the book, and also they didn't have the network of retail stores that we have in this country today. But speaking of Twain, we're going to do an edition of Huckleberry Finn, and which is just an absolute delight. There's one wonderful story I'll tell you quickly about Huck Finn, that there was the book is filled with the most wonderful illustrations, the original edition. And one of the engravers of the illustrations was unhappy about something. It wasn't with Twain. He was unhappy with the printer. And so he introduced a rogue element into one of these illustrations, and that particular plate has come to be known as the Priapic plate, because he had the character, a male with his fly undone and part of his anatomy hanging out. And it was the plate was made, and it went to the printer, and it was printed. Now, that particular plate, it's pretty clear that it never was bound in, but it did get printed, and it got as far as getting to the bindery. So there's more to that story, but it's just one of the sort of wonderful pieces of the treasure trove of anecdotes around Huckleberry Finn.
You're certainly not going to add that plate.
No, we determined that it really was not part of the real first edition. We're going to try and find a way to sort of share the information with our subscribers and perhaps even do a reproduction of that plate, which exists, but not actually bind it into the book, because as good a story as it is, we're pretty sure, and bibliographers are pretty sure, it never was actually bound in.
Twain must be part of the public domain by now, huh?
Twain is part of the public domain. That's correct.
That'll give you a break if you can find a first edition. Do you yourself collect first editions?
I do. I mean, I think of myself as having the kind of the broader disease, which is the book disease. I never thought of myself as a collector. I just thought of myself as someone who bought a lot of books. But one of the nice things about working on this project is that we have slowly begun to build up a very interesting collection at the office.
People walk in and say, Henry, wow, look at all those first editions. You must be a millionaire to afford all these books. Speaking of being a millionaire, how much are these books?
The books are $34.95. We also create a slipcase, which is optional, and I guess I didn't bring one with me, that it's a protective cloth-bound slipcase that has the front and back panels of the jacket reproduced on it, which is $5 extra. So they're $34.95. For our subscribers, they're $29.95. The subscribers get a price break because they sign up and they get them regularly. So they're, as I said, they're a little pricier than the regular trade edition, but they're still affordable. And for someone who is a lover of this time, they're a tremendous break off of what you would have to pay for the old-fashioned one.
Oh, well, if you could find the old-fashioned one.
If you can find the old-fashioned
one. Well, they are available, but I was just reading a biography of Faulkner here. Fascinating how he was able to function as well as he did in spite of his heavy drinking habits. Just fascinating. And how few books he actually sold in his lifetime, mm-hmm. and how he had to supplement his income working at the post office and working very feebly in Hollywood. It's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah.
And the fact that here this Nobel Prize winner really made no money at all on his own books until actually won the prize.
He really had given up. Faulkner wrote two novels early in his career, which are pretty much forgotten today, except by Faulkner buffs, called Mosquitoes and Soldier's Pay. And
they were self-published, I believe.
No.
Mosquitoes was self-published, wasn't it?
No, both were published by Horace Leverite.
Mm-hmm.
They were very much unlike. They were not about Mississippi. They were not about the Faulkner people that we associate with his later work. But after that, he began to work on this notion of what he referred to as my little postage stamp of the world, and that little patch of Mississippi. And when he had written, began to write these books, no publisher had any interest in him whatsoever, and he really believed that he'd given up. He said, I'm only writing for myself, because he truly believed that no one was ever going to publish him. When he wrote The Sound and the Fury and sent it to Alfred Harcourt, Harcourt sent it on to Harrison Smith, who was the ultimate publisher, saying, you're the only one in New York I know who's crazy enough to do this. And in fact, Harrison Smith did publish it, but there was just no money to be made. You know, you mentioned working in the post office. In fact, I think before that, when he was writing his I Lay Dying, he was working in the power plant at the University of Mississippi, and he had the night shift. And he was married and had a child, and was would go and he claims that he would go and after he and his attendant or his assistant had wheeled some wheelbarrows of coal around the power plant, he'd turn it upside down and he'd write all night. So it was not a glamorous or commercially rewarding kind of enterprise at all.
Well, you really know your stuff, don't you? And you're right. With every one of these beautiful books, there is a story behind it, isn't there?
Yeah. I'll tell you one other one which is amusing is the great story about, which brings in Max Perkins, who was, of course, the legendary editor at Scribner's, who was the editor for Hemingway, for Fitzgerald, for Thomas Wolfe, and was himself a fairly modest man. And Scribner's at that time was an august and distinguished house. And when he was publishing Fitzgerald's This Side of Paradise, which was the big breakthrough book, I mean, it was Fitzgerald's first book. It was one of the first books that Perkins himself had convinced the house to take, and was a real cause célèbre at the time. It was a modern book. And there's a wonderful story about Scribner's at the time, which was that one of the men on the sales force had a sister who was thought to have her pulse on the public taste. And so he would take books home to her and have her read them. And inside the sales force, it was very highly thought of if he came back and reported that his sister had given it a positive report. Well, Perkins was so concerned about This Side of Paradise, he didn't want anybody inside the house to read it. He didn't allow it to go to copy editing. The first edition is filled with errors because Fitzgerald was not a good speller, and neither was Perkins. But Perkins didn't want anybody inside the house to know about the book. Once it came off press, this salesman took the book home and gave it to his sister to read. And everybody waited on bated breath on Monday morning when he came into work, and they asked him what she'd said. He just looked at them and said, she told me that she had to put the book into the fire with tongs because she didn't want to touch it with her hands after reading it. So it was just, we think today of it being an almost kind of dated Edwardian book. In fact, it's still a book of exuberant youthful rebellion, but it was just absolutely scandalous in 1920 when it was published.
Well, Mr. Reith, we could probably talk for the rest of the day about books. I can see that we both share a love for them. You obviously have a background in publishing. You said you worked at Doubleday. Were you an editor or what?
No, well, I started out actually as an editor in the down the street at Harper & Row years ago, and got out of publishing and came back in, worked at Doubleday for a number of years in their book clubs, and then came back into the publishing side. And then I was president and publisher of the trade division for a couple of years in the early 80s.
And Doubleday.
Mm-hmm. And left.
Yes, the name is very, very familiar.
Left in 85 and really got this thing up and running just in 87. So
this is a full-time project.
This is a full-time project. We're a small company.
Obviously also a labor of love for you, too, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I mean, it's just, as I say, it's a thrilling project, and all of us who work on it, and there are four or five of us in the company, and we enjoy it immensely.
Well, these are beautiful books, and it's a wonderful thing you're doing, and I certainly wish you the best on this, and here's a chance for us to talk about it on the radio and maybe tell a few more people about the first edition library. Henry Weath, thank you very much.
Thank you, Don.